The American dream seems to me to be a fiction that most of us believe that dovetails really nicely with white supremacy mythology and serves the 1%. It's the water that we swim in and we don't know because we're the fish.
What white supremacy does beautifully is to assert trauma in order to create a sense of loneliness, dissociation, and disembodied experiences. So what do we do? How do we make visible the invisible?
Well, I think the first place to start is with our own bodies. Like, what happens to me when I walk into a room full of black people?
If you were to be invited to mediate between Hamas and IDF, what would you do or say?
I would first attend to their bodies, and then I would have them, without words, recognize each other's humanity, let their nervous systems come down. That's, frankly, most of the work.
Wow.
I'm Jill Nagel, and what I want to say about belonging today is that we are at peace when we feel like we belong to the land. We are at war when we feel like the land belongs to us.
Hi, Jill Nagel.
Hello, Rajkumari Niyogi.
I'm taking these deep breaths because I am so moved at what today's conversation will bring. You have been published many times as an author. Your first book, I think, was Whores and Other Feminists. You are the creator of a somatic counseling approach called Wisdom of the Body. Mm-hmm. And you're an innovative facilitator, which I know well, but you are here because you believe so deeply at your core around the need to dismantle white supremacy.
Mm-hmm.
You have built a framework that addresses that in multiple ways. I want to dive into that. And you support white learners. That is kind of your core deal. So we are going to be talking about white supremacy for this entire conversation, dismantling white supremacy and the mythology of white supremacy. I want to start out super spicily. We're going to get into it because there's no time like the present. And that is meant both philosophically and quantumly. You talk about Europeans that fled harm. And they were looking for a place where they themselves could belong because they were in the process of being wiped out for various reasons across many millennia. You talk about Black people in the U.S. who were tortured and enslaved and raped legally. This is a word that you used for 250 years. What is the American dream, Jill?
Well, the American dream seems to me to be a fiction that most of us believe that dovetails really nicely with white supremacy mythology and serves the 1%. I was thinking about money and how we're enjoined to invest our money. And this is considered to be a sign of maturity. Like, you know how to invest your money. But what we're doing when we invest our money is we are lending it to the 1% with no guarantee of any return. And the money actually doesn't really exist in that we could not all take out all of our investments, all of our savings at the same time because that money, quote unquote, is being lent to other people. It doesn't really exist. The amount of money that is currently assigned to people's personhood, their wealth or net worth, exceeds the amount of resources we have on the planet to be able to buy things with it. So the American dream is a lot about money and exploiting the resources of the planet. Well, the United States is 6% of the population is consuming almost half of its resources. So I would say the American dream is not sustainable. But to bring it back around to belonging, I want to quote David Levine, my partner, who said something this morning, or was it last night? I don't remember. He said, we are at peace when we feel like we belong to the land. We are at war when we feel like the land belongs to us. And so when I think about the history and the creation of white supremacy mythology in the U.S., I think a lot about belonging and how vital it is to belong to the land, and how the First Nations tribes who were here were in this beautiful symbiotic relationship with the land, with the flora and the fauna, with the birds, with the rivers, with the marshes. And when the European quote-unquote settlers came along, it was under the guise of a blatant white supremacy mythology.
What is white supremacy?
Well, so let me take on the whole phrase white supremacy mythology, because sometimes people say, wait, are you saying that white supremacy doesn't exist? And then they got their dukes up and say, no, hang tight with me for a minute. So first of all, white is a fiction that was created during the times of enslavement to differentiate enslaved people of European descent, like the Irish, from enslaved people of African descent, because they almost united and rebelled. So whiteness and blackness were created in order to oppress and enslave and differentiate who was enslaving whom. And those categories have persisted. People in Africa don't think of themselves as black. They don't call themselves black.
That is actually true. Yeah.
So white is in opposition to black here in the United States. Mm-hmm. Supremacy has two meanings. One is that something is actually superior to something else. Like the supreme gasoline that you get is superior in some ways. It also means maintaining dominion over.
Right.
Regardless of one's status. So the mythology that maintains the dominion of people, light-skinned people of European descent, aka white people, mythology that maintains white people's dominion over others economically, politically, mm-hmm. being able to stay lively, mm-hmm.
Right.
It's real. The mythology is that white people are superior, and that is not true. However, mythology also means ways of thinking and stories that are woven into the fabric of our daily lives. So in that sense, white supremacy mythology is so much a part of the air we breathe. It's the, you know, it's the water that we swim in and we don't know because we're the fish. As an example, I was watching a show called The Orville, which is a knockoff of Star Trek. And, you know, a lot of times black people will be cast as a particular alien race. And in this case, it was the Moklin. And there was an elder of the female tribe of the Moklin who were cast out of the male tribe, but that's a whole other plot. And she was this wise, respected elder. And when the white Orville team went down to hang out with her, they were allowed into her inner sanctum, at which point they found that she had an altar. And on the altar were all of these photographs of none other than Dolly Parton. And this was very well done. It was funny. It was charming. And when, I forget her name, when she has this sort of, you know, come to deity moment, she's sitting in the holodeck and Dolly Parton appears. And Dolly Parton gives her the wisdom, you know, and Dolly Parton is beloved. You know, so many people love Dolly Parton. And she's a white woman.
Mm-hmm.
Here is this black-like woman who could have had anybody, but the white supremacy mythology showed up as this coded black alien person having to go to a white woman mm-hmm. for the answers. And it's so slick and it's so funny that you could miss that part of it. And my partner's used to me just kind of ranting through these things. Mm-hmm. So it becomes impossible to enjoy mm-hmm. mainstream media because it's rampant.
You say here that white supremacy mythology is so interwoven into daily life, we barely see it.
Mm-hmm.
how do we start to address this as white-bodied communities?
One of the things that I like to do is to start to shift the conversation away from, in general, away from who is racist? How racist are they? Am I more racist than they are? Was that thing that I said racist? Are we going to argue about how racist that thing I said was? I think there's a time and place for that conversation. Mm. However, there's a larger conversation that I want to enclose that or encircle it or undergird it, if you will, and even if you won't. And that is, how does white supremacy mythology impact all of us as light-skinned people of European descent, coded as white people in this culture? Mm. And that's a way of taking stewardship of our own psyches mm. and saying, hang on a second, I don't want to be brainwashed by this anymore. I don't want to be in the throes of this. There was a campaign in Texas. There was this problem of litter, these, you know, beer-swigging, truck-driving guys would toss their bottles off on the freeway. Texas was littered. And don't litter campaigns were not working. So they did something really brilliant. They came up with this campaign that said, don't mess with Texas. And they appealed to the masculine protector stewardship, I love my state, kind of patriotism.
Wow.
Right?
That is genius.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's that kind of shift that I'm talking about of, hey, wait a minute. I've been brainwashed. I never consented to being brainwashed. I'm here at the throes of this knee-jerk, reactionary, white supremacy, mythology-drenched set of behaviors. And I don't know how I got here.
The tenets of white supremacy, I love that example. That is such a fantastic example. The tenets of white supremacy, and I talk about this all the time, there are several, but there's a core foundational tenet. There's a tenet of extraction, for sure. There's a tenet of urgency, for sure. There's a tenet of non-communal aspects. So do everything alone, right? Isolation, you've got this, be a superhero, and figure it out on your own.
Like that book, The Places You'll Go, it's supposed to be this adorable little Dr. Seuss book. You get it for graduates. And it's all about this little creature who you know is a white male who has to face everything on his own. And there's monsters and there are abysses and there are so many obstacles. And never once does he get help. Never once does he get like information. It's heartbreaking, actually.
The foundational tenet of white supremacy is do no harm.
What do you mean?
That I exist in the world as me, and I don't do harm.
Oh, I see what you're saying, yeah.
So even while I am in the process of harming through extraction, through urgency, through non-communal ways of engaging, which are harmful, because when we break down communities and we isolate folks, we have an epidemic of loneliness, and there are truckloads of data in this research around the impact neurochemically, neurobiologically about that. Even while I am harming, even when I am the perpetrator or the abuser, my belief system, my psyche, as you say, is that I am not harming.
I don't think that most white people want to or are consciously harming others. The problem with white supremacy mythology is that we're born elevated to privileges in a certain way. I mean, some people might listen and say, but I was raised poor and my parents were abusive. Yeah. And imagine going through all of that and being Black. All
or any community.
Or brown. Yeah. All one is saying when one says you got white privilege is that of all the things that have happened to you, racism against Black and brown people was not one of them. I think the tricky part of being, for example, a white middle-class liberal or progressive person who knows that they are not racist is that if I'm a good person and I care about other people, and let's say we're in a crowded bus and your foot is wrapped up in the bus jolts and I step on your foot, I say, I'm so sorry. Can I get you some ice? Can I help you? I try to repair the harm.
Mm-hmm.
But with in a white supremacy mythology-based culture, we're all so interlocked and embedded in this system that there is no one thing that any one person can do to rectify it.
So what do we do? How do we start to see something that's not seeable? How do we make visible the invisible? Mm.
Well, I think the first place to start is with our own bodies. Like, what happens to me when I walk into a room full of Black people? And learning this, the foundational skill, what I teach is a word I coined, beingwithness. It's the quality or act of being able to be with what arises within us without acting on it, without judging ourselves, or if a judgment comes up. It's similar to mindfulness, but it has another...
It's acknowledging what is.
More than that, to actually be present for it.
Mm-hmm. But and then, I can be present with it when I'm acknowledging that it's happening in my body. Mm-hmm. There's science to actually acknowledging what is. Mm-hmm. When we actually start to have the acknowledgement of what is, it actually hits the prefrontal cortex, moves to the amygdala, and then actually starts to shift the vagus nerve. So the acknowledging what is by naming it, noticing it, mm-hmm. is a very, very powerful tool. So you know, you did Wisdom of the Body. Mm-hmm. Your gateway into acknowledging what is in the moment of being present is through an embodied experience. And we can only dismantle white supremacy mythology through an embodied stance, no?
That's how I see it. Rezma Menakem's work uses the term somatic abolitionism.
Yes.
And I want to come back to being withness because I see it as an ongoing process of how I internally position myself in relation to what arises.
And just to be clear, it's being withness, mm-hmm. not witness, withness.
Right. Being with the quality or practice of being with what arises in us.
Yeah.
And I think acknowledgement is a fantastic place to start in all of the things that happen that you describe with acknowledgement. And then as the feelings and the judgments and whatever other things arise, we can choose to be with those too and to attend to that. And I call this a foundational skill for white people in dismantling white supremacy because white supremacy mythology lives in our minds and our bodies as a fairly predictable set of knee-jerk reactions of mindsets that show up as defensiveness. And I have a lot of empathy for...
Why does it show up as defensiveness?
It shows up defensiveness for the very thing that I was going to say, which is I have a lot of empathy for people wanting to defend their goodness. So remember before I talked about, the bus lurches, I accidentally stamp on your bad foot, and then I try to do something to make it better for you.
Mm.
With the white privilege, with white supremacy mythology, to the extent that we benefit from the system at the expense of other people, it doesn't feel good to know, and yet there's nothing we can do immediately to rectify it, to make it go away.
But this would seem to me as so complex and so multi-layered that I am being, as a member of the white-bodied community, which I am not, but I'm saying if I were part of the white-bodied community, that I would have to contend with and reconcile a constant barrage of gaslighting, a constant barrage of conformity, and a constant barrage of colluding. So innately, as a member of the white-bodied community, I'm a good person.
Mm-hmm.
But as you say, I am benefiting from these paradigms that are in place because of my skin color.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm walking around, I'm colluding, I'm conforming, and I'm gaslighting also myself,
mm-hmm.
and mostly myself. How in the world Do I, as a member of the white-bodied community, even begin to address this? This feels like a trauma response.
Mm-hmm. Just like that. Just like one of the things I am fond of saying is that white supremacy is like barbed wire that we're born with, grown into our skin. So it hurts to tap it.
Oh my God, I can just viscerally feel that. That is such, like, I'm pulling back from you. It is.
I know, it's a horrific image. Sorry.
Well, no, please continue. This is so powerful.
So the first thing we can do with that, or any of the other horrors, environmental horrors, you know, there's so many other things that are going on in the world I am participating in too, you know, to be with it. And we also have needs as human beings for joy, for replenishment, mm-hmm. for baked goods, what have you.
Yes, Jill, who's also a baker.
Right.
You know, we definitely have those needs.
For sex, for recreation, for walks in the woods. We're not spending all of our time reckoning with any given thing.
Right.
So I think the first step is like a trauma therapist would not have you regurgitate your entire life's trauma and do all of your primal screaming in one session. They would have you edge into it and develop the capacity. I think this is analogous to what Reshma Menakem calls reps, to develop your capacity to be with these horrors. As a nation, as the United States of America, we have yet to reckon with our history of slavery and how those repercussions still affect us today. So some people are just waking up to it.
I'm just like, how do we begin to even reconcile?
Just like this. There are things happening all over the place. There are bubbles popping up of awareness, of reparations. You know, Reshma Menakem's body work is an incredible example. Cleo Monago's body work on critical thinking and cultural analysis, which was recognized by the CDC in 2015.
Wow.
Yeah, has done amazing things within the Black community. I have to say that I credit the core and the foundation of my insights around white supremacy mythology. I credit Cleo with that.
Yeah.
If it weren't for him, I wouldn't have been able to run with this, you know, from the white side, as it were. If you Google the phrase white supremacy mythology, it's specifically those three words together in quotes, you'll probably see either Cleo's name or my name.
Right now, we are in the midst of another war, the Israeli-Gaza war. It's taking center stage. You posted on LinkedIn just a few days ago, popped up in my feed. I am thinking more and more that it is the children who can lead us out of this. I'm going to start crying. Since the adults seem not to be able to, conditioned as we are into rigid hierarchies of victim and perpetrator, right and wrong, kill or be killed. How do we take the concept of rupture and repair and start to apply it to dismantling the white supremacist mythology?
Well, so I'm a big fan of starting locally. One of the things that I'm doing in my corporate work right now is looking at representation. It can be as granular as you're giving a list of sample names. Let's not make them all Anglo. Let's mix it up a little bit. Or we have images of Black people, let's at least some of the time have them with other Black people, not always wrapped around a white person.
Mm.
That's one thing. You know, a lot of times you'll see interracial relationships on television, and this is supposed to be a sign
of progress.
Yes. Right. But if you never see Black people together,
right,
you never see Black on Black love.
You're emphasizing the juxtaposition again, right? If you see Black people always wrapped around other white people, then that juxtaposition gets emphasized.
Yeah. And it's one of the ways that white supremacy mythology can express itself that, of centering white people again. So how can we repair the ruptures? We can do it one person at a time. Mm-hmm. We can do it one interaction at a time. As we become more aware and more internally resourced, white people can make small differences here and there, and those small differences can add up.
Two questions. How do we resource ourselves internally as members of white-bodied communities so that we can do that?
Being withness is a huge foundational practice because stuff is going to pop up in us all the time, and it's going to braid with historical trauma, with familial trauma, whatever our personality challenges are. That's going to be how white supremacy mythology expresses itself. For example, a lot of times a white person will say, oh, well, but that's just me, or that's just him. But being just me or just them in a context of white supremacy mythology can amplify harm to Black and brown people.
100%.
For example, I can be kind of clueless about boundaries sometimes. And I was visiting my friend Cleo in his agency.
This is me not saying anything about that. Yes.
Thank you. Okay. In Los Angeles. And I was apparently one of the only, or maybe the only white person ever to go. And I saw something that interested me, ADD moment on the
right,
wall.
Right.
So I went right over to it. And it turns out what I had done was I had gone behind someone's desk to their into their personal space and like picked up something or looked at it. In any case, I had crossed a boundary.
Sure.
And Cleo said something like, oh, look, your white entitlement is letting you go wherever you want. And I thought, for a moment, I thought, oh, but that's just me. I'm just clueless about boundaries. But being just me in that context was doing harm.
But you labeled it as ADD. So now let's take this to mental health.
Mm-hmm.
How do I, as someone, let's actually take this even broader. Let's zoom out and let's take the gun violence with shooters in the U.S. who are being labeled as the lone wolf or the person who has a mental health issue. That's just them.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. So my sort of come to Jesus or come to Buddha or come to Lilith moment, whatever you wish, was when I saw this this photo of Dylann Roof, who had recently at the time shot and killed a room full of people of African descent in a Bible study meeting. And to a person, my progressive and liberal friends were calling him a monster, lock him up for life, this horrible white person. And through talking with Cleo, I've come to see that as an act of dissociation.
Mm.
Of a white person saying, I am not like that other white person, whether it's Derek Chauvin or any of a number of white, Kyle Rittenhouse, white people who have expressed their isolation, their trauma, their agony at the broken promise of whiteness by trying to harm Black and brown people.
What is the broken promise of whiteness?
The broken promise of whiteness is that white supremacy mythology tells someone, we've been watching episodes of reruns of All in the Family, like Archie Bunker is a fantastic example. So the broken promise of whiteness is, so the promise is that because you're white, you get to be superior. But then, you know, your average white person, an Appalachian or an Archie Bunker or a Kyle Rittenhouse, they find out that they don't feel so superior. Maybe they were abused. Maybe they were sexually abused and they feel like shit every single day. That can't be their fault, right? They're white. Surely it must be a N-word person's fault, you know? The Black person is drawn and caricatured in this society as the scapegoat, as the person who the white person can be mad at if things aren't going their way, or the immigrant to point to.
Mm-hmm.
So the broken promise of whiteness is the delta or the difference between, you know, how come I don't get to be a billionaire like Donald Trump? If somebody as with his level of intelligence and competence can be that rich, then probably so can I. So he sort of represents.
You're putting intelligence in quotes, right?
Yeah.
Okay. Just wanted to
make
somebody
sure. with his obvious lack of abilities can be so powerful, then surely so can I. So he represents the hope that broken promise of whiteness can indeed, broken promise of whiteness can still be fulfilled. So my friends were dissociating, were labeling this bad person, that bad person, locked them up, you know, and I can understand why that makes sense on a certain level. And I had this moment where I was looking at this picture of Dylann Roof, and he had that same glazed over, dissociated look that my own son would have in the moments before he would have yet another violent tantrum.
Hmm.
And I thought, it even looked a little bit like my son. I'm like, that could be my son. That is someone's son. And in that moment, I realized that I am not separate from Dylann Roof. That the same white supremacy mythology system that created him also created me. And so he and I were inextricably bound. And I needed to start asking not how can we lock him away forever and ever, but how can this collective white psyche that is bound together by this thing called whiteness take collective responsibility for having created a Dylann Roof, for having created him? Imagine a dysfunctional family where dad's an alcoholic. I know that's really hard, a little stretch, right, for us. Dad's an alcoholic. Mom pretends everything is fine. Sister Jess is the cheerleader and tries to keep everybody happy. And meanwhile, the son, Brian, develops a heroin addiction. Brian is expressing the pain of the family. It's an act of love. He's unconsciously shouting out, help, help, help. And so the family focuses its attention on Brian's heroin addiction without ever admitting about dad's alcoholism. So Brian becomes the identified patient in the collective psyche of the family. Similarly, In the collective white psyche, the Dylann Roofs and the Derek Chauvins and the Kyle Rittenhouses of our collective white psyche are the identified patients. And we white people put all of the blame and all of the shame onto them as if we are not all part of the same system.
This is brilliant.
That's why if you look at my LinkedIn profile, you will see that I say that my pronouns are we, our, us, in order to take collective responsibility for this mess of a dysfunctional white supremacy mythology psyche that we were all white people, all part of.
I'm just taking a deep breath because we are getting super spicy now. And I am really appreciating your vulnerability. I am really appreciating how you're showing up in this conversation. It takes me back to Ubuntu.
Mm-hmm.
And dignity.
Mm-hmm.
It takes me back to dignity. How do we hold dignity? How do we hold humanity if we are not in this together? If we are not in this together, we are not going to get where we want to go. It's not going to happen. So going back to the war, you, as a Jewish woman, how are you holding this? What is the answer? What is it that we need to do collectively to come to a place of unification and harmony? How do we do this?
So I hear you calling for solutions, and I sympathize with that. And one of my learning edges that Sunja actually helped me.
Well, if you're going to name her name, you got to talk about who that person is.
Sunja is an amazing person who has helped me a lot. I'll just say that for now. Is learning to be with my own helplessness.
This is so powerful. To be with your concept. Your helplessness.
Mm-hmm.
Because having the experience of helplessness is terrifyingly uncomfortable.
It really is, especially for someone who likes to get shit done and feels bad every day that I haven't saved the world.
Well, I want to get to the white savior complex and that statement in and of itself. But before I go there, talk about this experience of helplessness and how we as a collective, from the white-bodied community, how do we start to address this helplessness?
Well, you brought it up in the context of the war. And I've been heartbroken. I've been breaking down, crying at different points of the day. I held one meeting for other Jews just to let people feel their feelings and come together. And then I saw that Jewish friends of mine who were posting things on social media that held nuance, that held complexity, that held the contradictions, that held so many facets, were getting slammed by both sides. And that it's really easy to post, you know, a meme that foregrounds anti-Semitism or foregrounds the oppression of the Palestinians. The thing is that all these things are true. So I called another meeting for those I saw who were holding the complexity, because I know what that's like. I know what it is to feel isolated and to just be in our grief and witness each other and be with the complexity of it all. So I want to invite any Jews who are listening to this, or if you want to come as an ally of a Jew together, feel free to reach out to me at evolutionaryworkplace.com, Jill at evolutionaryworkplace.com. I'm holding these groups. They're free. They're my gift. I think they're necessary right now. I'd love to connect.
You're the one, actually, who taught me about the Walt Whitman poem, We Contain Multitudes. I have used that many, many times. And how we show up as human is when we hold the paradox. How we show up as human is when we hold the complexities. How we show up as human is when we hold the nuances. And we are not taught to hold nuance, complexity, and paradox. It's just not the way that our brains are not only trained, but conditioned.
Right. And we're taught to rush to the conclusion and take charge and get it done. We're not taught to slow down and be with and let emerge.
It's hard to do that in a state of helplessness. It's really hard to do that in a state of helplessness. Martin Seligman has written quite a bit on learned helplessness. The foundation of learned helplessness is the main contingency piece is uncontrollability.
Yeah. I'm not talking about the kind of helplessness that comes out of trauma, but more the helplessness that comes out of realizing one's own limitations as a single human being in the face of a large-scale atrocity like Israel and Palestine.
How is that not a trauma response when I am conditioned to not be in community? When I'm conditioned to not be in community, I find myself alone. We've already covered the effects of loneliness as something that is rather detrimental to our neurobiology, our neurochemistry, how it impacts mental health issues on so many levels, depression, anxiety, all the things. You even say here that we are craving more connection because of the epidemic of loneliness, and that the UK and Sweden appointed ministers of loneliness. I didn't even know that. And that's amazing. And I'm so concerned with the title of Minister of Loneliness.
That's the same thing David said. Yeah.
It should be Minister of Connection.
Yes.
I wrote this down because when we have a sense of connection, we secrete oxytocin. When we have a sense of connection, we secrete endogenous opioids. When we have a sense of connection, so much can occur neurochemically.
Yes, and that can help heal the sense of helplessness. But for me, it was, for different people, it might be a step forward or a step backwards. But for me, who wants to rush in and fix things as my sort of knee-jerk reactionary thing to soothe myself, it's actually healing for me to say, this is beyond my ken. Just like in 12-step programs, the first step is to admit that we didn't have power over something.
And that is where the antidote to uncontrollability comes into play, which is controllability. The antidote to uncontrollability is controllability. And where we find controllability is to name that we are powerless. That is giving us the sense of an action, a movement towards something.
And to do that with other people.
To be witnessed. You, again, were the person who introduced me to William Ury. U-R-Y.
Yeah.
And being witnessed and the third
side.
The third side. Yes, thank you. that, you know, as I run these compassion circles, these healing hours, and I run all of the content, the belonging boot camp, and understanding humans at work, at I belong, the number one thing that occurs is the community, the cohort that comes together and gets to be witnessed and seen. And the thing that I hear over and over is, well, now I feel better. How do you know? Because I was witnessed, I was heard, I was held.
Mm-hmm.
What's the role? I'm gonna throw this at you here a little bit because I kind of have a little bit of a clue of what you might say. What's the role of NBC here?
Well, that's interesting because
let's tell people what NBC is.
So, nonviolent communication is an approach to how we think and speak, based in the work of Marshall Rosenberg. He has a book called Nonviolent Communication, The Language of Life, or maybe it's called Compassionate Communication. Anyway, it's abbreviated as NVC. Mm-hmm. And there are offshoots of NVC, like Convergent Facilitation, developed by Mickey Kashtan, who recently came out with a book called The Highest Common Denominator. And it's a brilliant model of facilitation that it kind of takes the best of, you know, Robert's rules, but, you know, quick processes plus consensus, and comes up with something really efficient that takes everyone's needs and perspectives into account and helps make decisions. But anyway, mm-hmm. So I have a body of thought around the one two-letter word in the English language that hijacks our brains. Almost no one guesses what it is. So we externally reference using the word is a lot. This is right or wrong. And nonviolent communication is a way of helping to get us internally referenced to say a truer thing. Like, for example, somebody might say, oh, this party sucks. Now, that might be true. They might have run out of food. The beer might have all spilled everything. So it might be true that the party sucks. But what was even truer to say might be something like, I had such expectations. I was really looking forward to a good time because I just didn't want to think about my breakup. So that's a truer thing because it's referencing internally. Internal reference is also what scientists are doing when they observe. They're not judging. They're not interpreting. They're observing. They're saying, when we add this solution to this solid, that we witness this happen. We reproduce the experiment 17 times, and this still happens. So now we have this observation that's been tested. So nonviolent communication is a practice of internal reference. Observations, feelings, and needs. And then the final one is requests. Would you be willing to do this? However, people can use nonviolent communication in an externally referenced way, like, oh, that's not a feeling. So they're sort of thwarting the spirit of nonviolent communication in the beginning stages by stumbling around and annoying people. And I'm very familiar with that because I have done that.
Is there a way in which we can leverage this way of internally referencing the world mm-hmm. so that we can start to work with dismantling? Yeah.
And it's a practice. It's a life practice to feel our heartbreak. It's a life practice to be with our own reactions instead of immediately shifting to a judgment, a slogan, a meme.
Isn't the mythology, the white supremacy mythology, all coming from heartbreak?
I don't know. I know it's a pretty intricate, powerful, slippery, and insidious system. And I suspect that there's some profound core attachment wound or something at the heart of it. I don't know. And I don't know how to tell.
If you were to be invited to mediate between Hamas and IDF, what would you do or say?
Well, first, I want to make sure that the people who came to mediate were willing to mediate.
Let's say they are.
And they weren't going to kill me.
Let's say they are.
I would first attend to their bodies. And then I would have them without words. I would do it without words for a good long period of time to have them regard each other and breathe and get to a place where they can where their bodies can recognize each other's humanity and they start to co-regulate a bit as two humans instead of as two, you know, caricatures, ideological entities, enemies, but let their nervous systems come down. That's frankly most of the work.
Wow.
And that's why I think David has been using AI to create these pictures of children, because children don't have those defenses laid in usually.
Right.
They can more easily access each other's humanity.
How do we take all that we've talked about today and apply it to organizations? What do we start to even tell our leaders? Where would we even begin to invite them to think through? Because they need action steps. So what is it that they need to hear right now that can move them toward bringing a greater sense of understanding for themselves, as well as how to start to even show up in even tiny ways for the team?
Realize that this is long, slow work that's about showing up again and again and again with curiosity, with interest, with compassion, and learning. There is no quick fix. There are two things that I do primarily with leaders. One has to do with strategy, with choices that they're making and how they're creating a program or writing a brochure, or, you know, how do we frame or represent or structure something. And another is to do with conversations. And you might be surprised, or maybe not, at how many of these questions come down to having a conversation with someone. Well, you know, I said this thing to this person, they reacted like this, and now I need to go back and have another conversation with them. So first we work with their body. I work with what's happening in their body, the things they're telling themselves, the assumptions, because they go up these sort of ladders of inference, if you will, that, well, they said this, so that must mean this, and that must mean this about me and then about them. And so they've got this story going, and we sort of peel that back and help them foreground the outcome that they want, their values, what's important to them. Because for most people really want to be a part of things getting better.
Yeah. So this is your framework. This is called White Supremacy Mythology Mindset Continuum. I'm just going to read a few things because I think this is really powerful and really amazing. When we understand how white supremacy mythology creates our mindset, we can better evolve beyond it. For me, this is self-awareness. This is self-reflection. This is something I teach in organizational health. The three pillars of organizational health are feedback, accountability, and self-reflection. That I think actually another thing that you've taught me is that we actually don't learn from experience. We learn from reflecting on experience.
I taught you that?
I'll give you credit for now.
I don't remember that.
I'll give you credit in this conversation.
Yeah, it sounds like something I would say.
This is not about blaming white people or calling anyone racist. It's about understanding how history produces our mindsets and learning to move beyond them to enjoy greater clarity. Sovereignty. I love that you use the word sovereignty, because sovereignty is the antidote, or the antithesis, I should say, of helplessness and the effectiveness at stopping harm and transforming injustice. A person may inhabit one or more of these things at the same time, or they may move back and forth over time, actively and intentionally shaking off, oh wow, white supremacy mythology haze may need to be repeated over a lifetime. Oh, that's really beautiful. As white supremacy mythology keeps reasserting itself and getting reinforced by others. Wow, there's the heartbreak, there's the collusion, there's the conformity. So how you have this broken up, broken down, which is so, so beautiful, is these different columns at looking at mindset. But when we think about overt white supremacy, when we think about the denial of the contrarian ways of showing up, when we think about being a well-intentioned liberal, when we think about shaking off the haze, when we think about allyhood and advocacy, and we think about, I think, the ultimate state that we want to be in, the idyllic state. And I am just now noticing the colors of the chakra and the way that you have put this together. Oh my God, with the root chakra being overtly racist or overtly white supremacist, and the indigo purple being the idyllic anti-racist in a white-bodied community. This is so powerful and so beautiful. And as I look at this, I just think for a moment, where am I in all of this? Where am I? And I think, honestly, I will be very forthcoming here. I think I'm in the green, shaking off the haze, waking up to reality, seeing how we've been gaslit, feelings of rage and grief and despair, and thinking through next steps and appreciating and emphasizing the importance of stepping into what it means to be an ally. I always say that it's important to be an ally outside of the conversation and to be a human inside the conversation. Talk a little bit about this framework, Jill.
When I lead white-on-white workshops, helping other white people have effective anti-racist conversations with the people in their lives, like Uncle Fred at Thanksgiving, or whoever, you know, they meet somebody on a bus who makes a comment. A lot of times the first impulse on the part of a white person encountering another white person who seems racist is to push them away, put them down, internally scoff and roll their eyes. I maintain that it's an abdication of our white privilege not to engage.
I would fully agree.
Yeah. So as white people, we can go places that other people can't. We can be heard in ways. We can hear things. Things get said to us that don't get said to Black and brown people.
Absolutely.
So what gets in the way is that white people want to stay comfortable. We would rather not engage with the quote unquote other white people because we see them as separate.
Yeah.
We see them as other. We don't see that this is part of our collective white psyche, our big white dysfunctional family. Mm. So we go through very slowly what comes up, like, some people, and that this is where trauma response comes in. Some people freeze. Some people want to exit. Some people want to fight. I often want to fight. Some people want to fawn, and you know, all that's, and I've done that before too.
And let's just unpack fawn. Fawn is about pleasing or appeasing.
Yes. Yeah. So we, in real life, you don't get to push pause, shake something off, self-inquire, because the person's right there. The bus stop is coming, or Uncle Fred has moved on to the next conversation. But in these workshops, we get to slow way down, rewind, shake it off, go through our feelings, cry, whatever, go through it, and then come back and try it again. Feel our feelings, go through whatever we need to go through, come back and try it again. And so we're laying down new neural pathways so that the next time we get into a real conversation, we're going to have something practiced. And one little trick that we do is to have in our back pocket, if we're feeling triggered as all fuck, and we can't go through any of it, we can't do any of that, we sort of cock our head and put a pleasing expression on our face and lean in and say, huh, can you tell me more about that? So we all practice that because it's very disarming, because usually somebody who makes some kind of racist comment, they're coming out of their own knee-jerk reactionary white supremacy mythology-induced trauma trance, and they're not expecting someone to get curious. And sometimes, and I got this part from Cleo too, sometimes all it takes is the right question just to begin to unravel it.
Absolutely.
And we have those opportunities all the time. Not as much because of COVID, but if there's a white person in front of us saying something ignorant, we have a golden opportunity to help. And when we abdicate that, as Asia Davis of the Human Potential Project says, she's a woman of African descent. She says, one less racist in your life, white person, is not one less racist in my life.
Ooh, I want to just take that. Take that in. So I want to take that back to the corporate world. And a beautiful tool that leaders can start to employ immediately is to really have that curiosity as a tenet that guides their leadership style. And to even in a team meeting, as there is some comment that is made that is dismissive in any capacity, it doesn't necessarily need to be a racist comment, just any dismissive, exclusionary comment, to take a breath, to slow down, to tell me more about where this knee-jerk reaction in essence is coming from.
Yes. I'm thinking of a manager I had when I was working in Silicon Valley. Her name is Elizabeth Carlosari. Hi, Elizabeth. And we were in a meeting and somebody made a sort of grumbly, under his breath kind of comment. And she just stopped and she said, "What's the subtext?"
Great question.
Right? She didn't call him passive aggressive. She didn't ignore him. She didn't make a snarky comment in return. She just said, "You know, like, what's underneath what you're saying?" And I never forgot that.
Were you in the meeting?
Oh, yeah. Happened?
So how did the person respond?
I believe that he was more direct. He expressed what he was trying to say more directly.
Nice.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's fantastic. We use a framework that comes from social justice reparations that we have coined as psychologically safe conversations. And how we move from disagreement to agreement is we actually start by asking the questions, what's the deeper concern?
Mm-hmm.
What are you most afraid of that might occur?
Yeah. Yeah.
To get to the unmet need is where
right.
we're headed. So that's, again, a conflation or a merging of NVC and...
Yeah, I think when we realize that people rarely say exactly what they mean and we don't fault them for it, but we help them get underneath it,
mm-hmm.
that's where the magic can happen.
Mm-hmm. Magic is real. I saw that on a car door yesterday as I was driving home from a meeting. Talk a little bit about the loneliness epidemic. Talk a little bit about how workplaces have to contend with loneliness from a cultural lens, right, within their own organizational culture. What are some things that we can do, practices, tools, that bridge that loneliness back to belonging, bridge it back to connection?
Mm-hmm. Mm. So...
Well, breathing is one of them.
I'm an advocate of that. Sometimes I find myself not breathing that deeply, and it's almost like I need to give myself permission.
Mm.
So when I think about loneliness, I think about the individualism that this culture engenders that's simply false. Nobody can do any of this alone. I mean, first off, we're symbiotically entwined with nature, right? Talk about breath. You know, I get oxygen from the plant. I breathe out and give it carbon dioxide. All the food I eat comes from the earth. We are entwined with the earth, but we're not conditioned to think of it that way if we're living in an urban life anyway. So we're also politically treated as individual units of rights and responsibility. When someone goes on trial, we're not putting the culture on trial that produced a killer. We're putting the individual on trial because they are seen as a self-contained, hermetically sealed unit of rights and responsibility.
Wow.
And then you have capitalism, which treats us as individual units of production and consumption.
Speak that truth, Jill.
Right? So how are we supposed to not be lonely? We don't have a culture that takes care of us. We're told we're immature if we don't save for retirement, when saving for retirement really means putting our money in vehicles that lend money to the 1%. The money doesn't exist anyway. It could all disappear tomorrow because it's not guaranteed. But we're immature if we don't do that to take care of ourselves because nobody else takes care of us.
Hmm.
That seems to me a pretty lonely and bleak existence. How we can repair that is just like we repair white supremacy mythologies, one action, one interaction, one sentence, one gesture at a time.
Mm.
For example, I was recently doing some work where I involved Let me back up for a moment and say, my first year of college, which now was a very long time ago, I took a course called Psychology of Management. And the teacher was someone named Dr. Peter Correa. He was wonderful. He said, if you remember nothing else from this course, remember this. Involve those who will be implementing the decision in making the decision. And so I brought that a lot to my work, and I recently started a project where I involved lots of people in creating the end product. As a manager, one can suggest that people work together. One can facilitate conversations on higher levels. It's pretty easy to collaborate, but yet we don't do that enough in the workplace. So that's one way to do that. Employee resource groups can be a really rich and creative way to bring people together from similar backgrounds and reduce the loneliness and the isolation.
So we're going to include the link to your framework that people can download and just kind of see where they might be in their own journey. So you mentioned you have a son. I have met this very precious human whom I adore, actually. As we close out this conversation, what is your hope for the world from the lens of the white supremacist mythology and dismantling that? What is your hope for the world that he gets to experience? And I see you're getting really emotional here.
I am getting emotional. Stop it. I would like for us to make it a point to have more slow conversations with each other where we get curious about what might unfold rather than, I know this is going to sound funny coming from me, rather than try to convince each other of our points of view.
I love this so much. In order for me to go there, I need to have an embodied stance.
Yes.
Yeah, right? In order for me to truly be present with the being withness, I need to have an embodied stance.
And to reclaim our lives and our humanity that has been snatched away from us by white supremacy mythology, I would say there's our opportunity and our invitation into a greater level of humanity.
I want to close with this quote from Archbishop Desmond Tutu, who was asked many moons ago, what do you do in times of despair? And he responded with, you show your humanity.
Amen.
Jill, thank you so much for making time to come on the show.
Thank you, Rajkumari.
That was Rajkumari Niyogi and Jill Nagel. Up next, creating an effective hybrid workplace with Cindy O. Young. Visit us at podcast.ibelong.com for all the ways to watch and listen to our show. You've been listening to Then, Now, and Tomorrow, an I Belong original series produced by Flowship. Today's episode was executive produced by Rajkumari Niyogi, produced by Mike Giordani, edited by Ramiro Gava, mixed by Alex Roses, original music by Dario Valderrama, production assistance by Tiari Boutte and Pili Melendez. Thank you so much for tuning in.